This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit is brought to you by you, the listener. It is almost the end of 2012. We're heading into a whole brand new year of podcasting. And, well, as you can understand, podcasting is not as lucrative as creating a trilogy based on the books of J.R.R. Tolkien. And yet we do have costs. We do have to pay our servers, et cetera, et cetera. So that is why we ask you for a bit of your support, if you are able to support us. And if you want to, if you like what we do and you want to help us out this upcoming year, you can join the many friends that we have that support us by either a one-time donation or even some do a monthly donation. Just go to sqpn.com/donate and help us to continue this series about The Hobbit and all the other series that we do over at sqpn.com. So again, your support, you can find out about how you can help at sqpn.com/donate.
sqpn.com presents The Secrets of The Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
And we are back again with another sequel to our very extensive in-depth analysis slash review slash reflection upon the first of the three Hobbit movies, The Unexpected Journey. Last time we ended our discussion right after the flashback to the Battle of Azanulbazar and Thorin standing up as the new leader of the dwarves. And today we're going to pick up where we left off. And of course, it is the meeting between the dwarves, Bilbo, Gandalf, and the three trolls. With, of course, the main question of the discussion being, can we cook it? Joining me today to discuss troll recipes and much more are the two usual suspects. We have a small fellowship here. Let's start with the ladies first. Inge from Groningen, the Netherlands, in the same country that I live in. Hi, Inge. How are you doing?
I'm a little bit cold, but I'm doing fine otherwise.
It's cold. Well, perhaps you can ask the trolls for some extra warmth and sit at the campfire.
Yeah.
Also joining us all the way from California, Dave Kale. Good morning, Dave.
Hello. I'm much more warmed up and awake now.
Nice. Very nice. And
sun's come out.
Well, we're gonna give it another go. I have no idea when or if this review will ever end, but let's talk about the trolls. This is a major scene in the book, and a scene that we have talked about in the past on this show at length, especially considering the fact that these trolls are the first trolls that we meet, actually, at least chronologically, that talk and that have a whole discussion in Cockney English about whether or not and how they can cook dwarves and the occasional hobbit. And we were just wondering if that would work, because the only troll that we've seen before that, or the only type of trolls that we saw in, at least in the movies, were they cave trolls or like very
mountain trolls?
Or mountain trolls, very mountain big trolls. Fierce, just very, almost like wild animals. I just watched The Fellowship of the Ring, and there's this amazing battle at the, you know, the grave site in the Mines of Moria, of Balin, and then this huge. They've got a, what do they say? They've got a mountain troll.
I guess those were cave trolls.
Oh, cave troll. Cave trolls. Well, anyway, they look the same as all the other trolls in the trilogy.
Yes, yeah, they really do.
And the only thing they do is just make very trollish sounds. So talking trolls, and especially this kind of funny exchange from the book, where there's just so much bickering going on between them, and it seems like a very silly scene, something straight out of a children's book. But how would it translate to the movie and in the context of what is supposed to be a much more epic approach of the original story? Before I give you my opinion, let's first ask someone who loves to cook, Inge, what did you think of this scene?
Well, What I didn't realize, what I only realized later, is that Tom is actually the same actor as Beaver.
He is.
William is the same actor as Gloin. And Bert Troll is the same actor as Dory.
They're actually attacking themselves.
Yeah. So I didn't notice that. I also, with the voices, I didn't notice that. But I really liked the fact that they were talking, because mm-hmm. they were also talking in a book, and from the book we also know that trolls are incredibly stupid, and they did a good job of capturing that.
Yes.
And of course the sequence is different from the book. Mm-hmm. In the book, like I said in the last episode, Bilbo goes first, and then he just sees the trolls, and then he's like, oh, I'm the burglar, I need to burgle something. So he tries to burgle a key from the pocket of one of the trolls, and then gets captured. Mm-hmm. And then the dwarves who are on the lookout are like, oh, it takes an awful lot of time for Bilbo to return. So one by one or two by two, I don't really remember mm-hmm. that. They also go over and then get captured as well and end up in sacks. And then in the book, at one point, it's Gandalf who does the timing. How do you say the taunting?
Delaying the trolls,
and so they turn into stone as the sun rises. But I can see that if you do that on that way on cinema in on screen, that's very boring to watch. So, you didn't warn me before, but I really was grossed out when the way how Bilbo was captured by the trolls.
The snot?
Yeah. And I was like grossing out, and you were only laughing and laughing. I was like, she's laughing at me. And then I
It was so funny. And the third time I watched the movie, there was a whole row of girls sitting behind me, and they didn't see it coming. And so it was even funnier. Their reaction was a lot stronger than yours.
I know.
So grossed out.
Yeah, I was very grossed out as well. But I was like, yeah... I kind of knew that if I was totally grossing out, that you would start laughing. So I tried to keep myself together. But in a moment that one of the dwarves was sleeping, and he was breathing in and out those butterflies, that was the most gross.
Oh, yeah, that one. Yeah, we didn't even mention that.
That was nasty as well.
That was very funny. And works really well in 3D, I have to say, those butterflies.
Yeah, so... For the action sequence, I was like, okay, I can see mm-hmm. why they do it like that, but I wasn't really hot on it. I was like, okay, this is totally, because I had a mental image of the trolls and the action scene surrounding it from the book, and this was just totally not the way I envisioned.
Well, in the book, it's more much more of a negotiation type of scene sequence with Gandalf, you know, doing all the impersonations, and then the trolls getting confused, and this was a lot more standard in a certain way. Although I didn't expect the second part of this whole sequence. I knew that there would be a fight because we'd seen some stuff in the production videos, but what I didn't realize that they would still end up all captured and in sacks and or bags, and then Bilbo having to intervene to stall them, and I also loved, and I don't remember from the chapter in the original book, I love the fact that one of these trolls is like an aspiring cook, and he's like, oh, perhaps we can use some more herbs, and the other ones just want to eat, and there's this whole kind of master chef type of vibe among these trolls. What about you, Dave, because we talked about this scene so often, how did you think it ended up?
I really enjoy it. The only part that really struck me as weird was mm-hmm. the way that the dwarves are captured. It seems very strange that that I mean, it's not very smart. It's like, mm-hmm. if we don't put down our weapons, they will kill Bilbo.
Yeah.
So they surrender, and now they're still going to kill Bilbo and everyone else.
Yeah, that's
true. It doesn't make any sense. I kind of get why they did it, because obviously the way that it's done in the book wouldn't work at all. It'd take too much screen time, and also it would make the dwarves look really dumb if they just wandered in one by one and got captured. And also, you know, this gave him a chance to do an action sequence, but obviously the dwarves were really getting the better end of the fight, so they needed a way to be able to end it.
Yes.
And this also gives them a chance to kind of to sort of build on the personal thing between Thorin and Bilbo. Like Thorin obviously, despite what he told Gandalf about Bilbo's fate, he's obviously trying to keep Bilbo from getting killed here, and it also gives him a chance to sort of blame Bilbo, like, thanks a lot, Bilbo.
Exactly, but, yeah. It's like the resentment is like, this hobbit got us into trouble, and look how we end up here. And
but both times I watched it, I was just struck by, that's not too bright, you know? Like, it's a little awkward. I think, I don't know if there was a better way to write the scene the way that they did it, but it definitely, like, it's definitely not one of the better scenes in terms of working.
It was an easy way out. Although I have to say, I love the thing that comes next, where Bilbo is first, you know, suggesting all sorts of, you got to skin them. And then all the dwarves are, what, you traitor? No, I'm going to get you for this. And then this change where he's like, oh no, you shouldn't eat him because, you know, he's infested. And they get even more mad. And then at one point, Thorin starts to understand what's going on. And that just this, the dwarves trying to outbid each other on the worms that they carry around. I thought it was hilarious. I also really like the solution of the kind of the way in which they dramatically introduced Gandalf, that he just hits the rock and it's all of a sudden reveals the sunlight. I thought it was a great filmic way to do this.
Yes. And it also is not, it's a very nice, subtle way to do magic. That was one of those questions where I watched the scene and I thought, wow, they found a way to do it that really doesn't fit any of the answers we gave on her riddle.
And it seems that this is the way that he does magic. It's always by just taking his staff and kind of like hitting the ground with it. And it creates a shock wave or whatever. But you could even say, if you don't like the whole, you know, Gandalf doing too much magic, you could also say, well, he's just very strong, and then he creates a certain vibration and it breaks stuff. Because
he just identifies weak points in stone.
Exactly. There is a totally logical physical explanation for this. And the same happens later on in Goblin Town, where there too, to save the day, he just hits the floor or whatever thing they're standing on. With his staff, and in a way, it's again evokes all sorts of Moses-like Old Testament scenes where the staff seems to be the thing that at least is the conduit for whatever power is invoked. But I liked it here. I think it worked, and it didn't. It was a very logical resolution of the whole thing. I thought it was kind of a pity that we see Bilbo delivering the horses, and then, you know, a couple of minutes later, they're gone for good. So there's not much enjoyment of the ponies once they're freed up. It did explain to me why there was this kind of strange, almost superfluous scene earlier on when they were, this is just before the flashback to Azog, where Bilbo wakes up in the night and gives his apple to one of the ponies. It's like, here, and names the pony, but I forgot the name.
Myrtle.
It was to establish a bond between him and the ponies.
It's also very mirroring what Frodo does to what's the pony called? The starving pony he gets from in Bree.
Yeah.
And then a Bill the pony, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
he
Bill.
Also feeds him all kinds of stuff out of sight. So I was like, it was like a kind of a nudge back to the Fellowship of the Ring.
Well, and the ponies have to escape. They have to, you know, they can't be eaten. And it's one of the interesting tidbits that Peter Jackson talks about in his director's commentary of The Fellowship of the Ring, there is an added scene that is not part of the book where they send Bill the Pony away just right before they enter Moria. And, of course, everybody knows that the Middle Earth is infested with orcs, and so the pony is probably going to be eaten just, you know, 1 minute afterwards. But then I think Gandalf tells Samwise, like, oh, he will find his way home. And that was deliberately introduced there because one of the other people involved in the production is like, you can't kill the pony. You can't even suggest that he will be killed. He has to get home safely. And so it was a concession to that animal sensitivity. And they did the same here.
Yeah.
Another thing that this scene introduced for me was a huge distraction for half of the rest of the movie. And it was a continuity problem. Because, answer me this, what happened to the troll Snot? It just magically disappears after this scene.
Me on Bilbo?
Yes. His entire, he is drenched in snot. It's not just a little bit of snot, like you sneeze and you just couldn't get out your handkerchief in time, but he is soaked with snot. You see it just in a few scenes after this, there is a little bit on his coat and then it just is gone. It's like, where did this snot go? Is this a part of troll snot that it just evaporates when it gets into contact, or is it because of the sunlight that it bugged me. I want to see snot on that. That coat is way too clean. And I think it is because they probably came up with that much later in the process. Because the scene between Bilbo and Gollum in the cave, his coat is a little bit used, but there is no snot whatsoever. So I was like, they should have re-added the snot digitally.
Yeah, maybe Bilbo cleaned it off.
Well, there is no time. There is no time. I've been looking for those moments where you would see him brush it off, but I couldn't find it, and I don't think it ever happened. I think it just magically disappeared. Or perhaps it was Gandalf who...
I noticed some other continuity problems with that scene.
Oh, really?
And that, at one point, Bilbo tries to save the ponies from the trolls, mm-hmm. and when they use the real horses, they are bridled and they are tied to the posts.
Yeah.
And when they, at one point, you can see they are computer generated, they are loose, and they are not bridled.
Oh, I totally missed that. Interesting. But anyway, I thought it was very, overall, I was very happy with the way this scene played out. And just knowing that for the trolls, they used the same actors, brilliant. Oh, by the way, I want to give a shout out to one of our listeners, Matthew Kampfhammer, who is actually involved in this whole motion capture of the trolls and many other scenes in The Hobbit. And he emailed me a while ago, or I think he sent me a Facebook message just thanking us for mentioning the motion capture department in one of our previous episodes. And so to me, that was like, oh, I can't believe we've got someone listening to us who is actually involved in the production of The Hobbit. And then the third time I watched the movie, I stayed for the entire credit scene. And lo and behold, his name was right there. So Matthew, thanks you so much for listening and great job. Can't wait to see more of your work in the next two movies. So we've got the trolls out of the way. And then what happens? Do they immediately arrive at... you've got the sequence
with... The troll horde. So they were like, because the trolls, of course, cannot travel by daylight. Mm-hmm. So Gandalf makes a point, they are from the mountains, mm-hmm. but they cannot travel by day. So there must be a troll house or
the
cave nearby. So they mm-hmm. go out and look for it. And what I liked about that scene is that they find, of course, the swords and everything
yes.
else.
Yeah.
And that they mentioned the Gondolin elves.
I missed that.
I don't know if they mentioned
the old elves.
Yeah, from the First Age.
I love that the way it was played, because Gandalf is talking to Thorin, and Thorin is just about to, you know, take that sword and examine it, and Gandalf tells him that it's elven made, and you see this rejection. He immediately tries to push it away, And he's about to just leave it there. And then Gandalf is, well, you know, this is one of the finest swords that you can get your hands on. And he decides to keep it. But it's almost reluctantly. And I love the way it was, again, very subtly played. Just great acting there. Yeah. And of course, it just enhances this, the trouble that Thorin has when it comes to elves.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to have anything to do with it. I also love the way in which Gandalf discovers Sting. Because we know Sting very well from the movie already.
And I loved how the dwarves react to it. Bilbo is like, oh, this is a nice sword. And then I think it's Balin. It's more letter opener
Well, it's when they are at Rivendell and then Elrond is examining all these swords and they have all these fantastic stories. And then, do you think there's a story attached to my sword as well? Well, it's not really a sword. It's more of a letter opener, really. Love that. Balin is my favorite dwarf. He's so funny. We also have that long-term investment scene where they're burying
Bilbo's chest.
At what point does Bilbo recover that? Is that on his way
when
home?
He gets back home. Yeah.
But is it in a book somewhere? Is it?
Yep. He and Gandalf go on a long journey. On the way back from the Lonely Mountain, and they stop by and grab the chests of gold and silver. In the book, it's played off less as the dwarves being greedy and more as like Gandalf suggests that they bury the treasure to sort of keep it away from robbers and stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was well done. It's believable that these dwarves are like, you never know.
And it's mentioned in the early chapters of the Fellowship of the Ring, kind of what happens with this gold that Bilbo gets it all. The dwarves don't get it, obviously, because they don't come home. They all stay at the Lonely Mountain because way more gold there.
They don't need it. Yeah.
But Bilbo never quite feels right about keeping the troll hoard apart from the sword and stuff. And he actually gives away most of the troll gold.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you can tell when we see him trying to hide all his treasure for whatever relative is hopping in that he still doesn't like to have that stuff anyway. I mean, it still smells of trolls, so it's not a good memory for him.
The next scene is that Radagast arrives.
Yes, I think it's. We first are introduced to Radagast through Gandalf, I think. And it's not really a flashback, but it's almost like, okay, let me tell you about Radagast, and then we switch to whatever Radagast is. And of course, now we're entering a more controversial territory. Radagast the Brown, we've already seen the actor. We knew at least what type of acting that this would be, more comic relief at least, and kind of eccentric, and yet I personally wasn't fully prepared to the kind of Radagast the Brown that they showed us, and it took me a while to actually get used to his character. Let's just not beat around the bush. Inge, this is your moment to tell us what you didn't like about the movie. Go ahead.
Well, so basically I could have lived without Radagast being in the movie at all. But I can also see that you need to tie to Dol Guldur. And of course, it's convenient to have Radagast around. But I think the whole scene that he's, for example, first to start off with, if I'm allowed to rant,
sure.
I will rant.
Go.
First of all, when he's introduced, there's a bird flying towards him and telling him something. And then he says, show me. And the bird you see is a robin. And robins do not hover like that. That's what hummingbirds do. So there's no way that a robin can fly like that. So that's, well.
But this is Middle Earth.
Yeah, okay. Well, and then then he's picking up all kinds of hedgehogs and he's tickling their tummies, and I was like, okay. And then it gets even weirder when one is sick and then he doesn't realize that he's kind of, that he's cursed, and then the whole sequence where he's removing the curse, weird, with the spiders and everything. So I'm like, it didn't really work for me. The whole character of Radagast didn't work, and also think the way he was acting, and for example, when he is going, in Dol Guldur, he's fleeing the scene with his Morgul blade, and then you see him showing up where the next to the troll cave. Mm-hmm. But then you have to realize that he with his bunny sled has to cross the Anduin River, go over the Misty Mountains, down with that sled, which is kind of it's weird.
But Inge, these are Roscabel rabbits.
Yeah, of course.
They're not just ordinary rabbits.
The whole chasing scene with that sled, which looked very fake in that high frame rate. So I'm like, oh man, I really wish that it wouldn't be there. So I really didn't like this bunny sled and Radagast. So.
What kind of Radagast would you rather had? A more serious one, or?
He is a bit eccentric, but I would have. I'm okay with Radagast being in a story because he is mentioned, but I think he gets way too much screen time. And for example, the whole scene of chasing with the wargs, mm-hmm. he also has no sense of direction. So the whole company is running off to and he's kind of trying to lead the wargs riders away from the company. So you see the company running one direction, and then you see in the background Radagast with his sled going towards them. So they run another direction, and then if they run the other direction, you see Radagast again. So he's not doing a good job leading the goblins or the orcs away from them at all. So I could have lived without that scene.
So yeah. I have to ask, some people go as far as to saying this is the Middle Earth equivalent of Jar Jar.
Well, it's not as bad as Jar Jar, because Jar Jar was just really that was just the more annoying. He was annoying and he was not funny. He was funny, but he was not the whole sequence of chasing him. It was not necessary in my eyes, but. Yeah, so I'm not mm-hmm. just not a fan of Radagast and the screen time he gets. I'd rather had seen other parts of the story being expanded in the time.
Right. What about you, Dave? Radagast to Brown.
I heard the Jar Jar Binks comparison, and I'll admit that when I first heard, I was like, oh God, he really is. but you know, he's really not on screen that much, and he's not that annoying. I think I would have preferred he be less weird and not eccentric, but just weird in a kind of lowbrow humor way with him, like, you know, having a weird, like, I hate the way they handle Pipeweed. They keep putting in subtle on-screen suggestions that maybe it's like marijuana. And it's so not, it's just tobacco. Come on. Mm-hmm. But people aren't going to take it that way because of the way it's presented on screen. I didn't like that. I thought I like the fact that they included him. I felt like they didn't use him well. Like, that whole chase scene could have done without it. Like, they mm-hmm. could have just had him say, I'll lead them off, and show a glimpse of him leading them off, and then have the dwarves run to you know, like, Gandalf says, all right, this way, guys. Like, it was totally unnecessary to have him lead the orcs around and around in a circle, only to have the orcs figure out that, like, well, this makes no sense. The dwarves are right over there. Let's just go over there, guys. Like, it to me, it felt like you just wasted like 5 or 10 minutes of screen time doing nothing. There was no story told. Nothing was added. It was just a pointless chase scene. And I felt similarly, less so, but similarly about the introductory scene of him with a hedgehog. It's like, you couldn't have found a more effective, less silly way to suggest that something's wrong with the forest than having him try to resuscitate a hedgehog. I just felt like they didn't use him well. I felt my problem was less with him as a character. Even I would have preferred he be less silly, but I just felt it was almost as if they outsourced those scenes to a different writer and said, we need you to write us some Radagast the Brown scenes. Like, the writing on those scenes was mm-hmm. just tremendously worse than the writing in the other scenes. Yeah. Like, they had no clue what to do with him. And I would have preferred, I actually felt like on the whole, he sort of got not enough screen time to, you know, or at least they didn't use his screen time well to connect him to the main storyline. It was like, instead of giving us really, really meaty stuff of him investigating the necromancer in the forest and figuring out what's going on, they gave us these pointless scenes of him doing strange, weird, nonsensical things. And so at the end of the day, you know, the kind of reaction of the audience is like Inga's. It's like, why was this person in the film? He didn't do anything. He added nothing.
And it's true that the him discovering what's going on in Dol Guldur it almost seems disjointed from his other appearances.
Made
in
no
the movie.
Sense. It was like especially with like my kind of feeling like my reaction, especially with Saruman's comments, was like. There's part of me that suspects that he ever didn't actually go there. He was just on drugs the whole time and hallucinating the whole thing. Because it was really kind of weird and sort of super sort of trippy, the whole interaction with the necromancer and stuff. But
yes.
I felt like my reaction was disappointment. I felt like missed opportunity. Could have done some really interesting stuff with them. Instead, they wasted him on a goofy chase and him resuscitating a hedgehog. It's like, could have done anything else.
I'm going to give a slightly different take on this. I do agree that it was a bit overacting, and that's something that I kind of saw it coming. Just having seen the actor, I was like, I'm not sure if this is going to be a great fit with the rest. Also, because most of his scenes were filmed completely on a different time, and he was alone. He never really got to see all the other actors, and so it almost feels as if they gave him just free reign, just do whatever kind of goofy interpretation you want. And so perhaps even the way in which they filmed it, or the moment that he wasn't part of the rest of the process, so perhaps, you know, that's also why it feels a bit disjointed. The moments where he was just cross-eyed and just a little bit over the top. But on the other hand, I have to say what I really liked was that they established him as this weird, nature-loving, tree-hugging hippie with the birds in his hat. I thought it was brilliantly done, and him having the bird poop on the right side of his face was just visually just so fantastic.
He's a Maiar. He's a Maiar.
Well,
Maiar
so
don't walk
is,
around with bird poop on their face.
So is Gandalf. So is Gandalf. I mean, again, I think it is a way to stress that these wizards, you know, great wizards, don't always make for heroic, in-control types like Saruman. I think it was funny to see later on the open disgust of Saruman Radagast. I've been eating too many mushrooms, which got a great laugh from our Dutch audience, of course. But it's also, I think that Peter Jackson wanted to establish a few more parallels with the Fellowship of the Ring movie, because we see the same reaction of Saruman when he meets Gandalf, and Gandalf is worried, and then Saruman is like, you've been smoking too much of that pipe weed and it's gotten to your head. And so it's the same type of like slight reference to drugs, and so he has the same disdain for Radagast. I personally thought that the hedgehog thing was kind of cute. It shows that even a big wizard or great wizard has, you know, is concerned with even the smallest of animals. And I thought it was a kind of a vulnerability in that scene, which I liked. And a certain, you know, like, oh, he's like almost forgetting everything else around him, just focusing on the life of this very small hedgehog and trying to save him, and then only realizing that, wait a minute, this is not just threatening the life of this hedgehog. There is something, there's evil magic going on. I loved the way in which they show him taking that stone and then extracting that dark magic, and you see it kind of flow into that blue stone of his. And it was like magic against magic. It was almost him absorbing the evil. Like a magical
I have
dentist.
No clue why that drove away the spiders, though.
Me neither, but I think it was because of his.
On?
No, I think it was because of his incantations. So he was exerting here, good magic, trying to cure and literally kind of trying to Like if someone is bitten by a snake, the first thing you do is like try to get the venom out of your veins, and that the stone did that here. And I think by doing that, there was probably so much good in the air that the evil spiders got away. It was quite a creepy scene, by the way, those spiders.
Well, I did like that. I have to shout out. I did like that his uttering, but that's the brood of Ungoliath. I was like, oh, they mentioned Goliath. Yes.
Oh, I totally missed that.
That was great.
I missed that three times.
Goliath is the mother of all spiders. And we mentioned the two trees of Valinor.
Yeah.
In a older episode. So you have this Morgoth who tried to destroy the trees. And Goliath was a kind of eating or poisoning the trees.
Hmm. Interesting.
And one of the descendants of Goliath is Shelob, and all this.
Nice.
So that's all. So the spiders you see in Mirkwood are also related to Shelob.
Oh, cool! All right. Well, another reason for me to go back and rewatch the movie. There was the whole matter of the chase and well, let's first talk about Dol Guldur for a second, because we see him. Venture, he walks over this bridge, and Dol Guldur itself, to me, looks very small, because I know Dol Guldur from the Lord of the Rings Online game, and it's big, it's vast, it's a really huge fortress. And this looked a lot less impressive. And I'm like, wow, that's a small fortress for someone like the Necromancer. I expected something a bit more imposing.
It's like his summer home.
Summer residence. I totally was taken aback by the appearance of this Ringwraith coming out of that statue. I love the way in which very subtly he enters, and then you see the hands of this statue clasp around the hilt of this sword. And you're like, uh-oh. And then you got the appearance of this Ringwraith. The thing that I was a bit surprised by was like, wait a minute. Didn't we only see this Ringwraith when you're wearing the ring? But then I was like, no, there are actually also wraiths and ghosts later on in the Return of the King.
And they are also riding horses going around the Shire looking for Bilbo Baggins in the beginning.
But anyway, I always thought that you needed the ring to see them. But then, thinking along those lines, I was like, well, isn't Radagast wearing a ring? Does he have a ring just like Gandalf has?
The thing to keep in mind is that the reason... So when they explain why Bilbo can see the Ringwraiths the way that he does, it's due to the fact that when wearing the ring, he's sort of partially in their world. And remember, he also sees Glorfindel revealed sort of in a different way when he's wearing the ring, because there's kind of these sort of two planes of reality, the mundane physical and kind of the high spiritual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Radagast, just like Glorfindel, comes from the West. In fact, you know, you could argue that he kind of even more so lives in the sort of this higher spiritual plane because he is a Maiar. Mm-hmm. So I think what we were seeing is we should step back. This is making the assumption that thing was a Nazgul, which, you know, there's no on-screen confirmation. It seems like the logical conclusion.
It looked like one.
Within the film, in the context of the film, so far, all we know is there's this dude called the Necromancer and that he's raising or manipulating or something dead spirits.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, assuming for now that it is a Nazgul, we were basically seeing it from Radagast the Brown's point of view. Radagast the Brown is a Maiar. He is a spiritual being.
That's true. So he must have extra spider senses.
Yeah, he doesn't even need a ring. Most likely doesn't even need a ring to see them. Now, what I thought was weird, the part that really struck me about this, and I think this points toward how they're handling the Necromancer, is that if this were Radagast the Brown from the book, mm-hmm. then what Radagast the Brown from the book would have said is, oh, look, a Nazgul.
Yeah.
Not, hey, there's this guy, the Necromancer, messing around with dead spirits. One of them attacked me. He would have gone to Gandalf and said, yeah, there's Nazgul over there, so probably Sauron. There's no discussion whatsoever about Nazgul or Ringwraiths or anything, which I think what that points to is I think they're changing the origins of the Nazgul.
You think?
I think in the book, in the chronology of the book at this point, the Nazgul have been around for hundreds of years. Yes. They're well aware of the nature of the Nazgul and all that kind of stuff. To me, what I think is going to happen, where they're going with this, is that what they're going to say is, hey, there's this guy, the Necromancer, messing around with dead spirits. And then in the course of unraveling the real identity of the Necromancer, that's how they're going to discover the real nature of the Nazgul. Like, oh, these dead spirits happen to be these nine guys that happen to have gotten Sauron's rings, including the Witch King and all that. Like, I think the White Council within the universe of the films doesn't know what Nazgul are at this point, and that they're going to learn about them through the course of this Hobbit film.
Interesting.
To me, that's highly unlikely. If you know what the White Council is, who are in a White Council?
I agree with that. Except I think so. Just the on-screen clues that you see, for one thing. First of all, like I said, there was no like, hey, that's a Nazgul. Like, there's no way if they were well acquainted with the Nazgul as foes, Radagast the Round would have recognized him, unless he's just a complete idiot. But even if he hadn't, the rest of the White Council, somebody would have jumped to this conclusion. But on top of that, there's this discussion about burying the Witch King, and we thought he was dead and all that. I think the Nazgul within the universe of the films are actually going to turn out to be kind of undead, raised spirits, and that's how we reveal the power of the Necromancer and Sauron, as opposed to being kind of these guys that just sort of never died and just kind of faded away. So, I think that they're going to be revealed to have – or that they fake them out, that we thought that they died, but they hadn't really died. But
it's due to the Necromancer's necromancing that they are actually –
It's weird, and it's definitely a huge change and from the books, but it just like I just don't understand. Otherwise, it's going to be completely absurd that they didn't recognize that this was a Nazgul. Yeah. It was like they're like the most incompetent White Council ever. If there isn't some sort of change in that storyline, I think.
But that's also why, for me, the whole the whole field trip to Dol Guldur didn't make sense because. Of course, it can be that in a book you see that at one point that Gandalf dashes off to consult Radagast, and then he, from what Radagast tells him, he's basically convinced that the necromancer in Dol Guldur is Sauron.
Yes.
When he gets back to the I think that's. That's in the story as well, in the movie as well, that he's away from a certain period of time, and then he returns, and then he has this information, and I think also he talks about to Beorn about this. That's why for me the whole excursion to Dol Guldur now in this first movie doesn't make sense at all.
Unless
they just change the story, but then that would make me very unhappy.
Well, they're completely changing the story. They're totally – so in the chronology of the books, at this point, they know it's Sauron already. No mystery left. In fact, they've known it's Sauron for a really long time, and what Saruman's been doing is just delaying them, saying let's just watch him for now. Let's not take action against him. But they've known for 100 years – the last time the White Council met was like 200 years ago, and they were well aware that this is actually Sauron that this is Sauron rising. And finally what actually pushes them over, the reason Saruman finally caves and says, okay, let's move against him, is news comes that Sauron has folks trolling the Gladden Rivers, where the ring was last known to be seen.
Yeah, I think that Saruman is getting nervous that perhaps he might have left Sauron just, with the Necromancer alone, hoping that might lead him to the ring.
Yeah, exactly.
And then
exactly,
when
yeah.
Sauron is about to get the ring, that's where he's like, oh, let's just go after him.
So the reason they're changing in the film, clearly, is because if they were to follow the books closely here, what they would do, what the first thing that would happen in this film is they'd be like, all right, let's go on this quest. And by the way, Gandalf's going to be busy dealing with Sauron.
Yeah.
The movie watching audience would be like, why do we care about this quest?
Right,
Sauron's the real bad guy.
Yeah.
Go get him. Screw this dragon.
I think so too. And it would be very confusing also because you presuppose a lot of knowledge.
Compressing sort of this investigation about the true identity of the Necromancer, which took place over hundreds of years in the book, compressing it down into the timeline of the film – allows them to have this mystery of a rising evil. Who is it really? Figuring it out, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I just so in the books, when they first discover the necromancer and they don't know who he is, their first thought as to who it probably is probably one of the Nazgul. So just the fact that Saruman sort of emphasizes like, oh, it's probably just some human being fiddling around with black magic. Yeah. As I thought about that watching the film the second time, I really thought it looks like these people have no idea what Nazgul are. Mm-hmm. Like this conversation's perplexing.
Especially because we actually get to see a glimpse of the necromancer through the eyes of Radagast, and well, we see that it's certainly not some whatever human magician. And so you'd think that Radagast would have communicated that to Gandalf, and that Gandalf would have said that during the meeting of the White Council. No, it's really different from just a conjurer.
Yes.
But that doesn't happen. And of course, Radagast isn't there to tell the story himself, so perhaps that's how they get away with it.
No one
there was no time.
That's also something weird. Wasn't Radagast part of the White Council?
I think he is.
He is, but I feel like, again, that's something in the books, like, they never refer to him, his role in the White Council. Actually, you know what? They never really even, they don't even necessarily talk much about who's actually on it explicitly. They talk about, they mention various people related to it. So his role in the White Council, it's sort of consistent with him. He probably was involved, but he probably wasn't attending their meetings regularly.
Yeah, he was too busy.
Like,
healing hedgehogs.
Yeah, he's kind of like the sort of the satellite member. He's like the on the ground investigatory guy.
Right.
He probably didn't spend a lot of time sitting around arguing with Saruman.
No consumption of mushrooms during our meetings.
The glimpse that we get of the necromancer was interesting, but I was also a little bit disappointed, especially with the strange, like, it looks almost like a Scooby-Doo sequence where you know, they zoom in on this mouth of this ghost, and it looked fake. It looked really like,
what was that?
I don't know. It just didn't work for me. I was expecting something
kind of
a bit
true
more
to
fancy.
The books, because Sauron, after his defeat... Mm-hmm. By how Isildur, he cannot take a human shape anymore.
Yeah, I know. No, but it was just this one moment where we this necromancer, either we zoom towards him or he zooms towards us, but there was this very kind of ghost-like mouth, and it looked so cheesy, and so I don't know, it didn't fit the rest of the. Of the animation. What was surprising is that Benedict Cumberbatch got credit for this second of appearance, and we didn't even get to hear his voice.
It could also be that he got credit for both being both the Smaug and the Necromancer, because Smaug, of course, also appears.
No, I think he's
so one bit of speculation I heard about that was, you know, if you recall when Radagast is doing his little exorcism of the hedgehog.
Yeah,
his voice kind of does something weird, and it almost sounds like sort of somebody else's voice is being layered over him. Mm-hmm. I heard somebody speculate that maybe that was Benedict Cumberbatch's voice.
Oh, and so that they're like he is overlaying his voice, like double incantations.
Yeah, well, what it was is that you know, it's obviously the necromancer's magic, and you know, like, they just did this weird effect where, like, you know, Radagast Brown's doing his magic.
Would be almost the same as the fight between Saruman and Gandalf
In the Fellowship.
Lord of the Rings. This is also because in Middle-earth, there's no such thing as shooting light bolts or something like that, blue magic crackling for your hands. So in Middle-earth, magic is with words. So it's kind of a battle with words. So then it would make sense to solve it this way.
What kind of language is he speaking there when he's curing the hedgehog? Is there any... Do we have, like, linguists that tried to figure that out?
I think it was Quenya or something like that.
I think... I don't actually know, but I know that there are people figuring that out, I'm sure.
Very cool. And then we go back to, the arrival of Radagast and him meeting. That was actually more extensive than I thought it would be, where he speaks with Gandalf, and Gandalf was like, just to calm down. and cleaning his pipe on his, with his beard. I thought that was funny and gross at the same time. and a lot of overacting again. The actual chase, I didn't like it because it looked very CGI, especially the helicopter shots where you see him running around, and it was too sharp, and I just felt like they ran out of time for
you
that.
You know what it made me think of?
No.
Pod race.
Yeah, it was similar to pot racing, yes. Although I think the pot racing looked more real than the bunny sled. I wasn't too bothered by the close-ups of the bunny sled. I actually thought it was nice and better than I expected. But then the actual like overviews where it's also too, I don't know, stylistically not necessary. You would never film a car chase like that, like from a helicopter shot, seeing, because who is doing that helicopter shot? It doesn't make sense. It feels contrived, and it's like, who is observing this? It took me out of the movie. Whereas then when we get these other helicopter shots where it's just sweeping over the landscape, it's, you know, that could have been a bird or something. But here it was almost like a helicopter following the chase. It's like an episode of Cops or something like that. And I just felt out of place. And the only thing lacking was a big, you know, light on the, like,
we've got the suspect in view and he's approaching the left mountainside. And
I didn't like it.
Also,
structurally.
I also had some continuity problem because when they are standing there near mm-hmm. the troll cave, there's all forest around them.
Yeah.
And then there's the wargs jumping out of the forest. And then Radica says, well, I will lead them off. Mm-hmm. And then you see this chase, and there's no forest where he is.
There is a scene that explains this, and it's very brief, but there is a moment where you see them, actually, you see the frontier between the forest and this kind of wasteland or with the yellow grass. Yeah. And you see the orcs commanding the wargs into the forest. So I think that they might have even added that later on to explain why we have this sudden shift in landscape. But I agree with you. It felt a bit strange and sudden that they're all of a sudden they're on a high plateau.
How did they get there?
Very much like what's the name of this plateau after you climb up the mountain after you...
Highmoor.
Is it? Yeah, it looked like the Highmoors, and I was like, there's no way that they could have gotten all the way there. But you see even mountains in the background. And so it's clear that they're all the way high up on a plateau. And I don't know. It didn't bother me, but it felt like a bit of discontinuity.
Yeah, and it was also like, and then they find the entrance to Rivendell by falling into a cave.
Yeah, that was weird. That was weird.
I was like, that's not how the entrance to Rivendell was in the Fellowship of the Ring.
It could have been a solution if they were actually on the High Moors, because then you'd be very close to the Hidden Valley and to have a hidden passageway. But if this is still apparently supposedly taking place somewhere in the Trollshaws or something, I don't know. It was confusing.
The geography of that scene was weird.
You're speaking with two longtime Lord of the Rings online gamers. So we have traveled these areas for so long, and I was like, where is this? There is no place like this.
Well, the only thing is that in the books, I think it's the Fellowship of the Ring. At one point, Gandalf leads them to Highmoor, so up the mountain, because he looks for a path with white stones, because that would lead to Imladris.
Yes.
And there's not no such thing. There's just this kind of crack in the earth, and then they fall into it, follow a very narrow path, which you could impossibly pass with horses, and then they end up.
But this is not the only way to Rivendell. This is just a shortcut that they found. I don't think it was meant to be, you know, this is the only way to get there.
Yeah. I found it weird. That's just my...
The other reason for this chase that I could come up with, but I might not be something that was in Peter Jackson's mind, but if you look structurally at the place of this chase in the story, it is around the same place that we see the chase between the Nazgul and then Frodo and Arwen. So Arwen has Frodo on her horse, and she's trying to escape the Nazgul. That sequence, that chase sequence, is very similar and even similarly cut as the bunny sled chase here. So yeah. Perhaps structurally, although I'm not sure if they do that on purpose or whether it's just me trying to make structure where there is no structure. But anyway, I'm just trying to find reasons for this chase because I was like, oh, there must be a video game coming up soon where the bunny sled is basically like one of the core parts of the game or something like that. But oh well. Let's forget about that. Let's move over to Rivendell. They find this path in somewhere in a cave. Again, I don't think that this is in a book.
No.
Can't remember. 3D was great there. You have this overview and you look through the cracks in the stone and it was fantastic 3D. And then all of a sudden they're in this exactly same spot as we've seen the Fellowship in the Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah.
Looked almost like the same kind of weather, same time of day, perhaps the same background painting, who knows. But they seem to be approaching afterwards. They seem to be approaching Rivendell from a different direction. Because I've looked at the way Rivendell is displayed in The Hobbit and the way it was in Fellowship. And at first I was like, wow, they redid Rivendell. But actually, no, you're just approaching it from the right side. So from the, let's say, the right side of the last homely house. And whereas I think in the Fellowship of the Ring, they're coming from the left, or even they're walking straight towards the last homely house. So I don't know. Let's talk about the scenes in Rivendell, and then of course the dwarves and how they misbehave or almost misbehave there. What did you think about that, Dave?
I was pretty happy with that. I, based on the trailers, I really expected a lot more lowbrow humor and the dwarves being buffoons, mm-hmm. and it wasn't that bad.
Not at all.
The humor was one of the things I was most satisfied by with this film, that it was really done in tasteful, moderate ways for the most part.
Yes. Not much slapstick.
No.
The bits
that were slapstick were actually did not come across as like just ridiculous. So like Bomber sitting on the table and Beaufort throwing the piece of food that causes him to weigh too much and breaks it.
Yeah, that wasn't too bad.
I thought that was really funny. You know, like uh-huh. what it was highlighting was just sort of how Beaufort and sort of how kind of clever and mischievous he is, which I thought was totally appropriate.
And I actually like what I thought was the funniest part of that scene is that they were actually first eating in the Library of Elrond or whatever, and it's all vegetarian. And then there's this one dwarf, and he tries to actually cook his vegetable over an open fire, trying to improve the taste of it. It's like, if I treat this like meat, perhaps it will become like meat. And it was so funny because he gets talked into trying it out. Just try a little bit. You're just like a parent to the children, you know, just try a little bit. And
eat
then
your
later
meat.
On, he apparently is converting to, you know, this vegetarian diet, and he's trying to roast it, hoping that it would taste better. I thought it was a hilarious detail. I loved Elrond in these scenes.
I did too.
Way better than the other.
Wow, yes, he was so awesome and looked
on
younger.
On his horse, he was magnificent on his horse.
Brilliant, his whole attire, the way he spoke. I'm pretty sure that they did a lot of digital makeup because you know he's got a lot of wrinkles in his forehead normally. Yeah. The actor, but I liked him so much more than the Lord of the Rings, where he was just grumpy and resentful, and he's like, perhaps he's projecting on Gandalf, like what he should have done himself when he was in Mount Doom, and he could have ended it right there, and he didn't. So it was much more an angry
Elrond. The explanation I've heard is he's less grumpy because his daughter has yet to have. Hasn't fallen in love yet.
Oh, that must be it.
Yeah.
He's not a concerned father yet. But I really liked that whole sequence and
oh no.
Yeah, oh yeah, we're approaching the end. Isn't it amazing how time flies when you're having fun?
Oh no.
But what I also loved was the way in which they did that whole scene under the waterfall, with the moonlight and then the moon shining on that piece of crystal and then that beaming upwards, and it's almost as if the paper becomes translucent and these moon runes appear. Again, structurally, very similar to the appearance of the door in the side of the Lonely Mountain, with, you know, even the same role of Gandalf.
You mean Moria.
Or Moria, sorry, what did I say?
Lonely Mountain.
Oh, sorry, Moria. It's probably going to be a similar door if it's a dwarf door. But I thought visually it was stunning. And so it's part of Rivendell that we hadn't seen before. So I thought that worked really well. And then it was just way too short. I also loved Bilbo's expression when he first enters into Rivendell, and you've got that crane shot of them walking on a bridge, which again has, there's an exact same shot, camera movement in the Fellowship of the Ring, except for there they're in the Mines of Moria, and they're crossing the bridge of Khazad-dûm. And if you look at it, that movie, it's exactly the same thing that they do here in Rivendell. And then you see Bilbo's expression, and he is like, oh, isn't it the most awesome place? So you can feel that they're setting up his nostalgia later on. I always wanted to go back to Rivendell. I just love that whole Rivendell sequence. And then they decipher the map, and then they know where they have to go. And yeah. It's despite Thorin, they're still very frustrated that Gandalf lured him into asking the elves for help. But you kind of feel that this is the only way. And but Thorin still doesn't want to see it. He still hates the elves. Well, with that, I think we have done a well-rounded discussion about this part of the movie. And, well, as the company of Bilbo and Gandalf moves on, we will move on in our next episode when we discuss the rest of the movie, or at least as far as we get. It's quite an unexpected journey. Thank you for listening to this episode. Thank you for your patience with us. We hope that you enjoy this in-depth discussion, wherever can you hear something like this. And we invite you to check out sqpn.com for all our other shows. If it's the holidays and you have nothing to do, we got plenty of shows that are like this one. And check out the Secrets of Middle-earth. If you like Tolkien stuff, you will certainly enjoy that series as well. You can find that one at middleearth.sqpn.com. And one last request. If you have a moment during these, you know, holidays, go over to iTunes and leave us a review. It is a great way to point other people to this podcast series. And feedback is welcome on our website, thehobbit.sqpn.com, or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is Hobbit Podcast, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. So follow Hobbit Podcast on Twitter, and that's where we tell you about our new episodes. See you next time. Thanks for listening. And may the hair on your toes grow even longer.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.